The wide receiver show this week. We're counting down the top 10 in football. Julio versus Antonio versus Odell. Also, why we're going to learn a whole lot about Dez Bryant in 2017 and how Larry Fitzgerald reinvented himself mid-career and is still so, so good. All that on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And we move along with our position rankings this offseason. This week, it's going to be people who catch footballs from quarterbacks. That would be wide receivers. Three shows left. Wide receivers, always a big one. Always an interesting conversation about who falls where in the hierarchy. But also, you know, looking at these guys, big variety of skill sets here that we're going to look at today.
And probably the most dynamic position in the NFL right now. I think wide receivers influence scheme both offensively and then what teams do defensively. They probably influence scheme more than any position in the league, which would make sense. You can align them anywhere. They cover more ground. They're just a dynamic position. And the thing to keep in mind, someone put it to me very eloquently a few years ago. They said, in the NFL, the wide receivers are better than the cornerbacks. And by the way, the defensive linemen are better than the offensive linemen. And that's the game. So these are the guys we're going to go over, Gary. Some of these guys are what really define their offense, and they're impossible to match up against.
Yeah, and our researcher this week is Ryan Lacy. He left a little note here. Of our top 10, six of these guys were first-round picks. Two more were second-rounders, and another was a third-rounder. Another who you probably know who it is was a late rounder, a sixth rounder. But, you know, it seems like a position that it translates pretty well as far as what you can identify from a skill set and whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah, I would agree. And what's neat is it's also one where there is room for growth, as any position there can be. But there's a real amount of polish and craftsmanship that goes into being a wide receiver. Route running precision, reading coverages, timing. It is such a precise position. So these talented guys also come into the league with plenty of room to grow.
All right. Well, let's jump into it. The top 10 here. If you are joining us for the first time, we do this AP poll style to come up with the ranking. It is Andy, myself, and our researcher. This week, that is Ryan Lacy. We all submit our top 15. If you get a first place vote, a player gets 15 points. Second place vote, 14 points. All the way down to 15th place vote gets 1 point. Andy's votes count as double. Double, it's like Jeopardy. Double Jeopardy. With the double, you know how it goes. I haven't watched that show in a very long time, but I think that's still how they do it. But yes, Andy knows a lot about football, so his votes count double here. But we're going to count down the top 10 at the end of the show. We will run down the others receiving votes. We had 20 guys receive votes this week, but let's jump right into top 10 right now with number 10.
Number 10.
That is T.Y. Hilton, Indianapolis Colts. The NFL leader in receiving yards last year. Kind of something of a surprising stat right there. Look, he's his calling card is downfield as a deep threat, but he's become a little more well-rounded, especially over the last season or two.
I was surprised when I don't look at stats until the end of the season usually, like especially individual player stats, and I like to see how close I can guess them, like get what percent. I can't get within 10% of most guys' stats. And usually, from watching the film, you can. When I heard Hilton had led the league in receiving yards, I did not believe that. I would not have guessed that at all. He had a nice season last year. He had about, 1,448 receiving yards. To me, when you watch the film, Hilton is not a true number one receiver. He might produce like that, and that's to his credit, but he's a guy that you have to create clean access off the line of scrimmage for. You can't ask him to line up on the line is, as we're going to use the term ex-ISO a lot today, and that what we mean is a receiver who is by himself on the weak side of the formation. It's where a lot of these guys, these top guys we're going over, that's where they play. Hilton is not that guy at all. He's not big. He struggles with the jam. He's more of a DeSean Jackson type of player. A little more. He's much more of a polished route runner than Jackson, but that's his style of game. And so you have to scheme specific ways to get him open, which is fine. He capitalizes on it, but he's not a difference maker in and of himself. He's a difference maker in the right setting and in the right offense.
Well, and they haven't had a whole lot going on opposite him. I mean, there's not really anyone to draw coverage away from him there in Indianapolis, especially with Moncrief hurt last year. You know, they've been searching for that number two guy. Philip Dorsett really hasn't become that guy. Jack Doyle emerged as a pretty nice player, but he's a little bit of a one-man band, and maybe, you know, he was targeted 155 times. I guess that's not too much. That's pretty typical for a guy who's on this list. It looks like five or six guys were right around the 150 mark in targets last year.
Hilton targeted 150, right? You're not saying Jack Doyle's targeted 150.
No, not Jack Doyle. Jack Doyle had less than 150. I don't have it in front of me. 155 for Hilton, which looks like it was fourth in the league.
What one thing that they do that's interesting with him is he's a vertical guy, as we all know. He's fast. He gets downfield really well. He comes out of the slot a lot, which is how you get a clean release for the wide receiver, because you're behind the line, so you can't face press coverage in the slot. So they bring him out of the slot, but they run him on vertical routes as well. And that's unusual because typically the guys who run the vertical routes are the ones who are up on the line of scrimmage because they need to have that advantage. You can't start 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage and get downfield on time. You have too much ground to cover. Hilton's fast enough that he can cover that ground. It helps him that he gets the clean access. But the other thing, Gary, is when it's zone coverage, a lot of times vertical routes from the slot wind up getting run against safeties. And when you get Hilton on a safety and he's going full speed, there's not a safety in the NFL that has a chance in that matchup. And the Colts, they're a vertical passing team. They do a really good job of manufacturing those opportunities for Hilton. And of course, they've got a quarterback who's going to take those chances and take advantage of those opportunities.
Is that the number one reason that teams don't use vertical routes out of the slot? Just simply the matter of the extra couple steps that need to be, you know, covered off the snap? Because it seems like, I don't know, it seems like that's something that would be susceptible against an opposing defense.
Yeah, it is. And look, let's not make it too black or white. I mean, teams will run vertical routes out of the slot. You do see it, and you're going to see it every game. In fact, it's just not the staple. Usually the routes are those mid-range or underneath routes, the Julian Edelman type routes, of course. But when you have a quarterback that's comfortable late in the down, so think another guy who does it a lot, he's going to be on our list, spoiler there, I guess, is Jordy Nelson in Green Bay. And they do a great job getting him in the slot against predicted zone coverages and getting him downfield. Well, think about Aaron Rodgers and his style of play and Andrew Luck. Those are two quarterbacks that are comfortable extending the play late into the down. They don't need to get the ball out quickly and find the rhythm that way. They can play 4 seconds, 5 seconds into the down. If you got that kind of quarterback, you can do whatever you want almost with your slot. But most teams, they have to have a schedule and play on time offensively. Even the Patriots, who have the best quarterback, think about them. They don't run their guys from the slot vertically a whole lot. It usually is the tight end who's up on the line of scrimmage to begin with when they're going down the seams.
All right.
Number 9.
This is Larry Fitzgerald, still going strong, age 33. Another slot guy. Not that Hilton's only out of the slot, but Fitzgerald almost exclusively out of the slot at this point. And he is this sort of, I don't know, would you call it a new breed of big slot guys? I feel like that's a trend that's come along in the last, like, 5 years or so.
Yeah, it is a little bit. I thought it came along about 12 years ago as well, possession receivers. Remember when the Lions drafted Mike Williams out of USC, the wide receiver? That was, at that point, I don't remember if he was a slot. He didn't play enough to really have an identity. But that was that era, big receivers were kind of, it was the end of the big receiver era. So right before Mike Williams, there were big receivers as well that played inside. Fitzgerald has had two careers, and they both put him in the Hall of Fame, especially when you put him together. He was an ex-ISO early in his career, and Anquan Boldin was the movable guy, the guy that was always going in motion and running the shorter routes. And that makes sense because Boldin, even when he was young, he was slow. Fitzgerald has now slowed down naturally, so he doesn't play ex-ISO up on the line. Now he's the Anquan Boldin. And what's really impressive, Garrett, actually, I interviewed David Johnson the other day, Arizona's running back, and we talked about their most important run in that offense, and it's something they call, what do you call it, 23 double, I think it was. But they put two tight ends up on the line of scrimmage, and they motion Fitzgerald down behind those tight ends, and they just run the ball between the tackles. Double team blocks across the board. Fitzgerald's job is to block the linebacker or the safety, depending on the structure of the defense. And I asked David Johnson, growing up, you watched Larry Fitzgerald. Did you ever imagine that, A, you'd be in the NFL, and B, that wide receiver would be your most important blocker on your most important running play in the NFL? And it's remarkable that Fitzgerald has had the humility to embrace that role, just like Hines Ward did under Bruce Arians, just like Reggie Wayne did. And Fitzgerald's now the best blocking wide receiver in the NFL, and they game plan around that in Arizona.
Is there something to be said, this is a bit of a vague conceptual claim I'm about to make, the Cardinals have never had great tight end play in the Arians era here. I mean, Jermaine Gresham's all right, but it's almost like when you have Fitzgerald in the slot with his blocking ability, it's almost like he serves as what would be a second tight end.
Maybe a little bit. I get what you're saying. The one, if you were to take issue with the statement, the one thing you could say, though, is, well, on his most important blocks, they're almost always out of two tight end sets. He's not blocking out of three receiver formations a whole lot. And when he blocks, they motion him into the formation. That's what's unique. He's not one of these guys that gets on the perimeter or cracks back and hits a safety when he's not expecting it. He's down there in the trenches blocking with everyone else, creating extra gaps. Typically, that means there are more tight ends on the field. I'm sure if Arizona had an opportunity, look, they've tried. Remember, they drafted Troy Nicholas, I think it was in the second round a few years ago, hasn't worked out. But if they had an opportunity to get a big, bad tight end, a guy who can block and still catch 50 balls a year for you, I'm sure they would jump at that opportunity.
Would you be surprised from an ability standpoint? From a longevity standpoint, or would you be surprised if this was Fitzgerald's last season, considering what he is right now?
That gets hard because, I mean, we all know he seems to have other interests outside of football, right? I mean, we've seen that at the MMQB. He's done stuff with us. So those guys are more inclined to retire a little too early rather than a little too late. But we've been saying that about Fitzgerald for years now. And let's say Arizona goes 9-7 and makes it into the divisional round and loses by 3 in that game. Do you see Fitzgerald walking away then? I mean, I'm asking. I don't know the answer to that. What do you think?
I think this might be his last year coming up. I think you make a good point with the, you know, he is interested in doing things away from football, and I think everyone's sort of acutely aware of what football does to your body and probably more importantly at your brain. The more you play, and considering the role he now plays in Arizona, I think this will be it for him. But yeah, like you said, I could see if this is a bounce back season for the Cardinals and they end up, sort of on that second tier of Super Bowl contenders and maybe they're a couple breaks away in 2018 from getting there, I could see him maybe being convinced to come back for one more year.
And it'll come down to Carson Palmer, too. I don't see Fitzgerald enduring a transition at quarterback. I think if Palmer's gone, I think Fitz will leave, too.
Number 8.
Well, let's jump ahead to number 8, a guy who did change teams here this offseason. This is Alshon Jeffrey. And I just want to ask you one question on Jeffrey, because to me, he's a very interesting player. And it was really fascinating to see what happened to him last year in Chicago with all the changeover at quarterback and the fact that he sort of got lost in the shuffle when Jay Cutler went away. Obviously, we think very highly of Alshon Jeffrey, considering where he is on this list. But how difficult is it for a quarterback who maybe hasn't played with, sort of a box out wide-bodied, face the line of scrimmage type of pass catcher. How difficult is it to get used to a guy like that? When look, if you're a quarterback, I'm sure a lot of guys are looking for open spaces to throw to, and a guy who gets significant separation and that sort of, you know, that's a little more comfortable to throw to.
It really depends on the type of quarterback. Look at Brock Osweiler in Houston last year. We're going to talk to DeAndre Hopkins later in this show. Osweiler and Hopkins never developed any chemistry, and a big part of the reason why, well, there were two reasons. One is Osweiler was not comfortable in the system. It's a very different system in Houston, so that's his own issue. But the other thing, option routes. He didn't like reading option routes. He wants to know where the ball's going before the snap, not after the snap. But the other issue is Hopkins does not get any separation at all. He is not a great route runner, and so he has to make those contested box-out catches. Well, you've got a QB that doesn't like reading option routes, and then when he does finally read the receiver never gets himself open, but it's a receiver you have to throw the ball to still. And that did not work well for Osweiler. He had a number of bad throws and interceptions to Hopkins. Some of those were on Hopkins, but there was never any rhythm or consistency between those two guys. I don't think you're going to see that with Carson Wentz and Alshon Jeffrey for a few reasons. One, Jeffrey's a much better receiver than Hopkins, and he can separate. I agree with your assessment. He's not Antonio Brown, where he's creating 8 yards of space on his in-cuts, but he is a better separator than his body type might suggest. But what makes him a top 10 receiver, you're right, is his ability to make contested catches. Wentz is willing to throw those balls. Wentz reminds me a lot of Andrew Luck. It hasn't shown up yet because that offense in Philly, they're keeping it simpler for him now and easing him into the league, so a lot of quick timing throws. They've told Wentz an 8-yard completion, we'll take that rather than a likely 20-yard completion. Let's just move the ball. That will change, though. As time goes on, they're going to expand their offense. Wentz will get more aggressive. And when he does, I think Jeffrey's going to be the guy. If it happens this year, and I think it will, especially late in the year, Jeffrey's going to be the beneficiary.
Yeah. Well, the other thing with Wentz, he probably was kind of used to not throwing to receivers who get a lot of separation. They didn't have a whole lot of dynamic talent in the receiving core last year for him.
And they still don't, is what's interesting. Jeffrey, I think, can change the makeup of an offense. Remember, Chicago ran a lot of three-step timing out of three receiver sets. That's what they did under Dow Loggins last year. Jeffrey, I know his numbers were down, 821 yards receiving, second year in a row that he's been under 1,000 or been in 800 range. He hasn't been on the field a whole lot, though, is why. But he was pretty, within the context of their offense, he was still productive. There were stretches where he looked like a true number one receiver. There were inconsistencies at quarterback. You wonder how that factors in. All those are non-issues now. They know the quarterback in Philly. The system's very clear. He's going to have time to work on it. And when things break down, he becomes the go-to guy still anyway. And you're right, they did not have that go-to guy in Philly. They don't have it outside of Jeffrey, though. I don't like the rest of this wide receiver core for Philly.
Yeah. No, me neither. And I like Torrey Smith more than you.
You do?
Yeah, I like Torrey. We've talked some Torrey Smith on the show. I like him more than you do. I like fast guys. I like guys, if you're going to be one thing, be fast.
Yeah, I like guys that can catch and run routes. But fast
that's
is good,
too. Nice. But at the very
that
least, I mean, you know, if you're a safety, if you're a safety, you can't, you know, you can't just say like, oh, well, that guy doesn't catch well, so I'm not going to bother,
right,
you know, reacting to him running, running down the boundary there. But
yeah, you're right. And so Jeffrey will have, and that's one thing he's never had before. He has not had a vertical threat on the field with him. And remember, he had Brandon Marshall in Chicago, but Marshall was a contested catch guy. So Jeffrey hasn't had someone who can take the top off the defense on the other side of the field from him. It'll be interesting to see if Philly makes use of that. I don't think Smith's going to be on the field as much as people think, but when he is on the field, he will run those vertical routes, and I'd like to see how they use Jeffrey in relation to that.
Well, we'll talk some Torrey Smith later when we get to him on the countdown here, but right now we're not going to get to Torrey Smith on this countdown. let's go number seven. This is Jordy Nelson.
Number seven.
Bounce back year coming off the torn ACL. You know, thinking back to last year, it seemed like he was a little bit shaky, a little bit rusty early in the season.
Yep.
Did you see a change as the year went on, or was this sort of a, you know, this was it a matter of Aaron Rodgers sort of playing at a superhuman level?
It was both, but within the discussion of Nelson, it was mostly Nelson. He got more comfortable mm-hmm. each week. September was his week, his month of growth and his transition back and getting comfortable again. He became his old self by October, mid to late October, certainly. And Gary, I think we can kind of touch quickly on Nelson because he's really a confluence of a lot of the things we've already talked about conceptually. We mentioned the slot and running vertical routes out of the slot, and Green Bay does a great job with that on Nelson. By the way, every time he runs those vertical routes, they almost always cross the field. So if he's on the left, the route's going to the right or vice versa. And that's something that really challenges a defense. And then the other thing with Nelson, he's very good on contested catches as well, mainly those back shoulder catches, which everybody can visualize when you think of Rodgers and Nelson playing together, especially when Nelson's running routes along the sideline. Those two things alone, he's polished in route running too, so he's very sound. Those two things are the contested catches and the ability in the slot. That's going to get you 800 yards a year in that offense right there.
Yeah. Yeah, he a little steadier from Ryan Lacy. Top passer rating in the league when targeted, 117.7 passer rating last year. A lot of that has to do with he was a big red zone producer last year. And then obviously, as we mentioned, he has Aaron Rodgers throwing to him, which also will help that number statistically. But yeah, he and Rodgers seem to have a nice connection down in those tight spaces when things get a little bit dicey.
Absolutely. And then the guy we're about to get to at number six, he has a different type of quarterback. And I bet you, I don't know what Bryant's stats were last year. I'm sure they were much less than Jordy Nelson's. I bet you that's a big difference, though. And I guess I just gave away the guy, didn't I? Yeah, sorry.
You did.
I'm stealing
you,
your show, Gary.
You did. That's the whole
Go
reason
ahead and
I'm
do
here.
It. Do it anyway. Fight through. Fight right. through this. Do it anyway. Announce him.
Number six
is Dez Bryant. And yes, Dez was down statistically. Well, I mean, look, he was down statistically 2 years ago when they had the rotation of Matt Cassel and Kellen Moore and all those guys. But he was especially considering how well Dak played. I think Dez statistically, if you are maybe a fantasy football participant who had Dez Bryant on your team, you were probably a little bit bummed out that he played 13 games and he had 50 catches for 796 and 8 scores last year, which is not what he used to do with Romo when he used to be putting up 1300 yards and 90 or so catches every year. But we've talked about with him before. I mean, he a guy like this, he has an impact in the run game as well. Just the fact that you have to constantly be worried about him.
You do, because safeties roll over to Dez Bryant's side. And when you talk to corners around the league, they all still mention Dez Bryant. So do coaches. So he's viewed, even though his numbers have not been as such, he is viewed still as a true number one receiver. Now, Dallas's running game has gotten so good that at some point you have to say, forget Dez Bryant, Ezekiel Elliott, those offensive linemen, those are the guys. We need an extra body in there anyway. Let's make Dak Prescott beat us. And I bet that's what's going to happen this season. And that's what we don't know, is will Prescott be able to do that? What's his chemistry with Bryant? How willing is Prescott going to be when it comes to making tight window throws, on-time precision accuracy throws? And I have no idea. We don't know that. He might be great. He might be bad. We have no idea. He hasn't been challenged in that way yet. At some point, he will be, and it'll come at sometime this year, sometime next year, whenever it is. Dak Prescott's going to have to be a big-time NFL quarterback at some point, and then we'll find out about him and Dez Bryant, and how that goes will impact Bryant statistically.
Yeah. Yeah, Dez, they had, I think of the Giants game when they lost at the Meadowlands in that Sunday nighter. They had some cross-ups last year. I don't know if it's a matter of Dak forcing the ball downfield in some situations or I don't know what you put it on, Andy.
What week was that game? Do you remember? Was that, are you talking the not the week one game?
I want to say
that
was
the
right,
second Cowboys game.
I want to say it was right
second
after Thanksgiving, but I will look it up right now. Yeah. December 11th, week 14.
Okay, so yeah, because I remember they played the Giants in week one and we said, Prescott didn't target guys. He was inaccurate, and that was kind of true that game, but obviously it didn't hold true over the course of the season. We'll find out about Bryant. We will. But for the purposes of our conversation here, we're talking physical attributes and what does he do when he's on the field, how does he impact game planning. He's still very much a top 10 wide receiver. His skills have not diminished. He needs to stay healthier. He missed 3 games last year. He missed 7 in 2015. But he is, as an entity, he's still a top 10 guy. But what we're wondering is if he will have top 10 production this season, given the nature of the Cowboys' offense. And I don't know the answer to that, but if he doesn't, that's going to be 3 years in a row for Bryant as a non-producer relative to other number one receivers.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Number 5.
This is Mike Evans, Tampa Bay Bucks, the most targeted player in football last year. 173 targets from Jameis Winston. I mean, look, this is something of an old school, chuck it downfield type of passing game. And Evans, for a guy, the book on him was always that he wasn't fast. He gets downfield, but it's sort of a contested catch type of situation when he gets downfield.
His contested catches, though, he's longer than these other guys. He's longer than Nelson. He's longer than Bryant. So his radius is significant, and he's a long striding runner. So he's going to play faster than his raw speed time, and his raw speed in and of itself suggests he would. It's a deceptive speed that he plays with. He's absolutely, I think he belongs exactly where he is on this list. If you had to argue, I'd say he might even be a tad higher. What the Bucks will tell you during this offseason, I talked with their coaches, and the thing that they kept bringing up was Mike saw too many double teams this year. Teams were rolling their coverages nonstop to him, which is, I'm surprised he was the most targeted guy in the league in that case. They still went out and addressed the issue, though, when you bring in DeSean Jackson. We talked about a vertical threat and how that might impact Alshon Jeffrey having that guy opposite him. Well, DeSean Jackson's a better vertical threat than Torrey Smith is, and he's going to play a lot more snaps. This will be a new year for Mike Evans, a new style of play, and he fits their offense very well. You said it, Gary, a downfield old-school vertical offense. They play that way because Jameis Winston's a little bit methodical and he's aggressive, so that's the best offense for him. And Evans, I think his style fits Winston's style very well.
Yeah, they've certainly melded nicely here. Do you anticipate Evans doing different things this year? I mean, what do you do now? Because obviously you can stick him on opposite sides of the field and have Evans and DeSean just take off. But do you expect sort of a more, I don't know, diverse, well-rounded Mike Evans in 2017?
Maybe. I think he's already a fairly diverse receiver just by the nature of the offense. Dirk Cutter likes to unbalance his formations, meaning he likes to put all his tight ends on one side of the field and his wide receivers on the other. And we've talked about that on this show a lot. You get a lot of benefits from that. Mainly, you get a man zone indicator from the defense. How the defense responds to that unbalanced formation tells you the broader coverage that they're going to be in. And now you're playing with an advantage on offense. So just the nature of that offense, Evans moves around. I don't see him as a movable matchup piece necessarily, but he is that. That is ultimately how he winds up being used. So I would think they'll continue to do that. And the other thing to keep in mind, DeSean Jackson, he might seem like more of the movable matchup piece. I always thought it'd be interesting to see him in the slot. They never really did that in Washington. It wasn't the nature of their route combinations to use him there. But I think Evans is a more diverse receiver than DeSean Jackson. Jackson's really the guy you're going to have to help with the scheme and benefit and, you know, game plan to benefit him, because he's not as complete of a route runner as Evans is.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Number 4.
Let's jump ahead. Number 4 on our countdown. This is AJ Green, who, I mean, look, it was a disappointing year for the Bengals all around. Green, for the first time in his career, did not cross the 1,000-yard threshold, but he did. He actually had his highest yards per game last year, the 96.4 in the 10 games he actually played on. He had never been above 90 in his career. But I don't know. It did. They had all sorts of problems blocking and protecting Andy Dalton last season. Was there any sort of issue with Green? I mean, you know, they obviously lost complementary weapons. Tyler Eifert was in and out of the lineup again. They had lost Marvin Jones and Mohamed Sanu.
Yeah, there is an issue with Green because when the blocking breaks down, Dalton does not play well. He's not a great pocket mover, and he's not great with pressure in his face. So he is more dependent on blocking than other quarterbacks would be, and that's kind of been the difference between the good Dalton and the bad Dalton that we seem to see every other week or so. And Green's directly tied to that. He's dependent on Andy Dalton. And their chemistry has improved every year that they've been together. They've been together their whole careers. They started the same season. But Green, you can see it. There'll be bouts of frustration with Green because the offense doesn't always flow as rhythmically as he would like. And every week you see him getting his job done. There, you don't ever put on the film and see A.J. Green not getting open, or A.J. Green, you forget he's on the field. That's not how it goes. He does get open. Yeah. He is very consistent, but the offense around him isn't always that consistent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked about, especially around the draft, we talked about, you know, they added John Ross, who was the fastest man in the draft and certainly had a hugely productive career in the Pac-12. You know, Joe Mixon is on, adding a little more of a dynamic, multifaceted threat to that backfield. What do you think of this Bengals offense overall? And I ask now because I think Andy Dalton is not going to make our quarterback show, unfortunately for him.
Yeah, I think Mixon will have an impact right away this season. He's a diverse running back, and we'll see what that means for them. They're more of a one-back offense now, so that's why Jeremy Hill is going to take a back seat. With Jeremy Hill, they're a two-back offense, but they have become more of a one-back offense, and I think Mixon will fit that better. So we'll see what that means. I don't think that changes A.J. Green's world a whole lot. The guy that could potentially change Green's world is John Ross, for the reasons we've talked about, speed opposite a number one receiver. But that's going to take some time, Gary. John Ross, he missed basically all offseason nursing the shoulder injury. He's transitioning into the NFL to begin with. They're good at wide receiver. Tyler Boyd is the slot man. They love Brandon LaFell as their number two because he does everything right. Doesn't always show up in stats, although he was productive last year. But he does all the little things that get lost but help an offense run smoothly. They're not going to take him off the field. So John Ross is your number four receiver right now. That's not going to impact A.J. Green significantly this year. Not this year.
All right. Well, before we unveil the top three, and most of you probably know who the top three are going to be, but perhaps not in the order they will come in, so might be a little surprise there. But before we get into that, just a programming note, we will have the big mailbag show, the giant mailbag show, what Matt Havia coined as the pool party mailbag show. We just don't have a pool or a party. We're just going to answer mailbag questions. But you can send your questions via the traditional routes, which is Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGremling_SI, Facebook, or talkback at themmqb.com. However, the big sort of life hack that we're giving people here, if you leave a question along with an iTunes review, we guarantee we will address that question on the mailbag show. That is a 100% ironclad guarantee. If we get 2 million reviews in the next couple weeks here, we will have just like a, I don't know, 48-hour show where we answer every one of the questions. But if you want your question answered, that's probably the way to go. Leave a review on iTunes. Leave the question right in the review. We promise we will address it on the show. How are you feeling about that, Andy?
I feel all right. I feel good about it. We get good questions, so I'm fine with it.
We do.
And the bad ones, we're going to read them still, but we're not going to talk 10 minutes on a bad question. We'll have some fun with them.
We also, and as we mentioned, we will probably edit some of these questions for brevity's sake so that we're not spending 4 minutes reading a single question. But yeah, that's the way to get your question on the show, guaranteed. Few guarantees in life, but this is one of them now. With that,
all right,
we return to the countdown.
Number three.
Number three, this is Odell Beckham Jr. I mean, look, he was sort of a one-man army for the Giants last year. They were just not very good in the receiving core, or really their weaponry overall outside of Beckham. And as we saw in the wild card game, the Giants lost in the wild card game. The Packers resorted to the, what do you call it? It was the Superman alignment, the two guys in press coverage.
Oh yeah,
on Beckham.
Yep. Some people call that the vice coverage as well, and you see it in the red zone more. Just two corners, two defensive backs, right up pressing Beckham at the line of scrimmage. Calvin Johnson used to draw that coverage in the red zone. Beckham, I don't know if I've seen him draw it in the field, like the 30, 40, 50-yard mm-hmm. line or not. I'd have to go back and look. I imagine I would remember if I did. It's typically a red zone coverage. But obviously, Beckham is a guy that gets double-teamed regularly. We know that. We don't need to dive into that. And that's going to remain true even with Brandon Marshall here. Beckham's still the guy teams will game plan defensively around. Gary, what to me, the discussion, as a talent, he's the best in the NFL at his position. He's a different type of talent than Julio Jones, so we could get into which kind of, do you like more, the bigger guy, the quicker guy. But mm-hmm. to me, the discussion with Beckham is, where is his head and maturity? Because, and you know, I don't get into that much. That's not something you can study on film. But with him, it's been very apparent that it has impacted his play at times. And so I think it is a relevant topic, is where is he emotionally? Is he going to be more of a professional?
Yeah, I mean, that was the one disappointing thing you'd say about last year. And I'm talking less about the boat trip, his passion as a boatsman, I guess, and more about some of the on the field antics, especially early in the year, because it was one thing, this all sort of came to light for the first time in the 2015 season, the Panthers game, the Josh Norman game, where things got really out of hand. And you figured, okay, well, you know, he's got a whole off season to sort of cool off and sort of recalibrate and that sort of thing. And look, teams pick on him. They go at him. They know he's a little bit prone to having on field meltdowns. And a couple teams got to him early in the year. And officials are also quite obviously, you know, have an eye on him during these things. He picked up some pretty fringy 15-yard flags last year, but you know, all eyes are on him, and he sort of seemed to have a persecution complex, which, you know, in that way was kind of, you know, it was kind of justified for him to feel that way. But it's also it's just the fact of the matter at this point, and he's got to come up with a new way of dealing with it.
If I were playing Beckham and I'm the defensive coordinator, I ask the head coach, I say, whoever our last guy on the roster is that we keep active, deactivate him this week. Give me an extra cornerback. I need a sixth cornerback. I'm going to start the game with that sixth corner, and I'm going to have that corner punch Beckham right in the face mask the first two snaps. And if the corner gets ejected, that's fine. We'll give up the 30 yards. But now we've hit Beckham in the face. Then I'm bringing in my starting corner, and I'm telling him, if you can keep your game mentally, which most corners probably can with this, every time the refs mm-hmm. out of earshot, I want you saying horrendous, awful things to Odell Beckham. And we're going to play from there. I'm not kidding. That's exactly what I would do. That, and I'd roll a safety over the top still.
Yes.
There's a blueprint out on Beckham. You've got it. You can get inside his head. That's unequivocally obvious. That hopefully will change at some point. If it does not change, it will get worse before it gets better, and that will eventually be what we remember about his career. There will be a little bit of a what could have been feeling with Odell Beckham. I hope it changes. I think it can change, and if and when it does, he's the most dangerous wide receiver in the NFL, snap by snap.
Yeah, and look, Giants are going to have to – I can't imagine the Giants not – signing him. I mean, you know, barring some sort of
they'll sign him, no question,
apocalyptic type of scenario here. But
when does that ever happen? When was the last time we saw a true, unequivocally bona fide superstar not be re-signed by their own team?
I only wonder, because look, we've seen teams, I don't want to say get better without a number one receiver. I mean, you know, the Lions didn't, it wasn't like, oh, Calvin Johnson's gone and now we're better. But we've seen teams sort of, there's something to be said for almost not having a true number one, and maybe it's a little too far in that direction with the Lions with the guys they have, and they sort of could use a true number one in that offense. But you know, there's something to be said for teams who have lost a top receiver and have sort of not only continue to tread water, but have even gotten a little more efficient offensively. So I wonder, it's almost like if there's one position you're going to do it at, maybe you do it with your number one receiver. And we saw on the market this year, I mean, Alshon Jeffrey had to settle for a one-year deal. I mean, there were number ones out there. A guy like Terrell Pryor didn't generate a ton of interest. But,
yeah. No, I hear you, but those guys both have question marks. And the Johnson, yeah, and I the teams that have gotten better without a true number one, it's because they've been great at number two, three, and four. It's the back end guys that blur the number one. It's not the absence of the number one. It's that they have so many weapons in their diverse offense. Green Bay was like that during the Donald Driver years when they went to the Super Bowl and they beat Pittsburgh. So I hear you, but it's not going to happen. You still want the true number one. The Lions would take Calvin Johnson back now. If they had a chance, they just would hope Matthew Stafford would continue to play with the discipline that he was forced to locate once Johnson went away. Stafford got better without Johnson because Stafford had to get better, and he did. And they've also changed the offense there. Mm-hmm. There's next to zero chance that Beckham will not be signed long-term. I don't think we even need to – whatever the numbers are, they're going to set the market too. I don't think we even need to wonder about it.
Yeah.
Who would you take, Gary, Beckham or our next guy? Who would you take? Because they're both very similar stylistically.
Right now, well, I'd take this next guy because I also ranked him higher on our ranking. So I guess I will stick by my vote.
Number two.
This is Antonio Brown. And by the way, if you're listening to the show on Monday, July 10th, it is happy birthday, Antonio Brown. He's 29 years old today. 5 years older than Odell Beckham. So that's the one reason where you'd say, like, okay, well, I'll take the 24-year-old who is, you know, an eighth of a step behind this guy. But Antonio Brown, number two on our list last year. He was number two this year. He was number one last year. It was an inconsistent year for the Steelers passing game. And they certainly leaned much more heavily on Le'Veon Bell as the year went on, but Brown still, you know, 106 catches, nearly 1,300 yards, and they get Martavis Bryant back this upcoming season, and I wonder if that allows them to sort of open things up a little more offensively, because it also seemed like when Sammy Coates went out last year, even though Sammy Coates is sort of the poor man's Martavis Bryant, it sort of took away a sort of a dynamic downfield element to this offense.
This offense has so many weapons and so many spots. I mean, they can be whatever they want to be, and they do that. And what's interesting, the way they use Brown, they move him around early in games a lot, and then as the game goes on, it feels like they play him more as an ex-ISO receiver, that guy on the backside by himself on the weak side of the formation. And I always wonder why that is. The other thing they like to do with Brown is when they go to an empty formation, which they do more now than they've done ever before, they spread out, they go empty. Almost always it's Le'Veon Bell in the slot on the weak side and Brown outside of Bell on that weak side. And those are the two guys on that side of the field. And I know Todd Haley likes to do that because he trusts those guys. He thinks Bell and Brown are really smart football players. And he mm-hmm. likes to use them in unison like that. Antonio Brown's everything you want in a wide receiver. He had some, you know, we could probably talk his maturity a little bit after last year. I felt a little more aberrational than anything. I don't think that's a big deal with the Facebook Live that he did and just lapse of judgment. Yeah, but as a receiver, he has honed his craft. He is so precise mechanically. His separation in and out of breaks is huge because his footwork, his foot speed is so great, and you mix that with the precision of his routes. And Gary, I spent time with Patrick Peterson last week, and I talked to Stephon Gilmore on the phone this week. Those are top flight mm-hmm. corners. And I asked them, who are the receivers that impress you? And they pretty much both said only one guy, certainly the first guy, that was Antonio Brown. And what they said he does, and each guy said it, he changes his approach over the course of the game based on how you play him. Brown gets an a great feel and a great understanding of the nuances of what his cornerback does and his technique, that corner's technique. And then Brown changes his technique accordingly. And they said it's extremely difficult to deal with. There's almost two versions of Brown, the one you see in the first half and the one you see in the second half, and that's what sets him apart.
It's the old improvisational jazz type of approach. My all-time favorite, Stevie Johnson. That was his old approach to route running and attacking cornerbacks as a guy who
he was
maybe
another
wasn't.
Great one. He was great at and he was not skilled at all. I mean, he did not have Brown's quickness. He was actually probably below average in that, and he was very good as a route runner and getting himself open.
I miss him very much. I hope he's. Did anyone sign him this year, Stevie Johnson? Sorry to get off topic here.
The other day. Nope, he's not. I think he's unsigned because he was in San Diego last year and he got hurt.
And he got hurt again.
And it's kind of been out now, and that's just what happens.
That's a shame.
So he's not our number one guy.
And Antonio Brown is still fantastic.
Number one,
Julio Jones is here. Takes the top spot. Andy, I'll let you do your Julio Jones thing, and then I just have one Julio Jones stat to share with you.
Well, what I see with Julio is I think what everybody sees. He is so strong, and he moves so well, and what you get is a guy that's almost impossible to defend, especially on in-breaking routes. So routes at slant routes, post routes, dig routes. Those are the three main in-breakers. He is hard to contest with on that. And the Falcons, they almost always use him as an ex-ISO receiver. He does not move around the formation a whole lot, and that's because he so consistently impacts the safety, and also because as an ex-ISO, when you're out wide like that, that's where you have to line up to run those in-breaking routes. You can't do them from the slot because there's not enough field inside of you. So it's very clear how he's used. They've obviously done a great job of maximizing him and maximizing the benefits you get around him. And I think when you factor in the strength, that's what makes him the toughest guy in the league to deal with because he's a good enough route runner. He's in that Brown class, not quite that quick, but he's so much stronger than Antonio Brown.
Yeah. And look, he's just a couple quick stats that researcher Ryan Lacy left us. He's number one all time in receiving yards per game at 96.3. But the thing, and look, it's because I'm something of a fantasy football dork, and I'm always aware of these things. But his red zone production, it makes no sense at all. I will never understand this. He just doesn't do anything in the red zone from obviously he has a role. He's drawing a lot of attention in the red zone, but he doesn't catch touchdown passes down there. It's bizarre. But my stat was, so over the last 4 years, Julio Jones has a total of 10 red zone touchdowns, which is something like, it was something like 52nd in the league or something like that. But he is tied for second among receivers named Jones with those 10 touchdowns in red zone touchdowns. He is behind Marvin's 13, and he is tied with James Jones, who didn't even play last year. So that's James Jones over 3 years versus Julio over four, 10 red zone touchdowns. It's bizarre to me.
I think the reason for it, if I had to guess, because the other guy we talked about in the red zone is Jordy Nelson. And James Jones and Jordy Nelson were similar receivers in this sense. Those back shoulder catches, those contested catches. You don't see Julio make those a whole lot. It's not really his game. What we've already established is his strength is running in-breaking patterns. In the red zone, the field gets condensed in the middle of the field, especially because there's no room for the safeties to be back deep. So they drop down lower, and it's harder to run in-breaking patterns when you get those extra bodies in there. That's the only thing I could surmise that would impact Jones's productivity is that his route running and his strengths, they can't be used in the red zone. He's not a back shoulder guy, which can always be used in the red zone. He's a guy that creates space, and there's no space to create down there.
No. All right. Anything else on Julio before we unveil the others receiving votes?
No, I think we're covered on Julio, and I know they love him there in Atlanta. They love him across the league. Every time you go talk to wide receiver coaches, they always bring up Julio Jones as the example of how they want their guys to do it.
Yep. All right. Well, that is our top 10. We now unveil the others receiving votes. As I said at the top of the show, we had 20 guys get votes this week. This will obviously start with number 11. That is Demaryius Thomas. Then we had Julian Edelman, Keenan Allen, DeAndre Hopkins, Doug Baldwin, DeSean Jackson, Pierre Garçon, Brandon Cooks, Martavis Bryant, and Amari Cooper. You wanted to talk a little more about Hopkins here.
I think, yes, because I think that's the guy people are going to say, how can you have him off the list? Cooper as well. And let's do Cooper real quick, Gary. Mm-hmm. Amari Cooper, because I thought he would be top 10. I didn't vote him top 10 this year, and there were two issues that stood out to me negatively for him. He does a lot of good things. He's very good at creating space and separating. He's a refined route runner. He's not a good catcher. He doesn't catch the ball. He has a lot of drops. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. The other thing is he creates space late in the route, but early in the route, he struggles to get off the jam, off of press coverage. And teams figured that out last year, and they started pressing him more, and that became an issue. And I fear it's going to be an issue again if something doesn't change with him. So that was my Cooper thing. But Hopkins, where did you have Hopkins?
By the way, before you get to Hopkins, did you see the social media pics of Cooper with the jacked up arms now?
I did not. What's up with his arms?
I don't know. He looks a lot bigger this year.
Oh, he's strong? Well, maybe that's the solution.
Yeah, there you go.
He needs to. He needs to do that. And that's. I'm glad he's done that. Let's hope it translates onto the field. Where did you have Hopkins on your list?
I had Hopkins 14.
See, the other day, it was a slow news day, and there was a legit debate that went around for a few hours across the internet. Who would you rather have, DeAndre Hopkins or Odell Beckham? Who's more impressive? And the people that were arguing for Hopkins made the point, well, if you gave Hopkins Eli Manning, what would Hopkins' numbers be? Hopkins hasn't played with a good quarterback.
Yeah.
And I get some of that, but let's listen. If you were to take that question to an NFL coach that's played against both those guys or coached those guys, that coach would, he might smile and say something polite to you, but somewhere in the back of his mind, he'd file you away in the idiot column and never bother thinking about you again. I mean, that's like Hopkins versus Beckham is LeBron James or Tim Hardaway Jr. Who would you rather have? It really is. And
that's a bit much for NBA savvy fans.
Well, Tim Hardaway,
how about
a LeBron? $71 million guy.
He is a $71 million guy. That is kind of sad. how about LeBron or Paul Millsap?
Okay, I like that, actually. You know why? Because Millsap's a slower, methodical player. And and LeBron's probably like more of a Julio type of guy, but you know what we're saying. Who's the Beckham in the NBA, the slasher? Curry, I guess? Probably Steph Curry?
I mean, would you say Russell? Russell Westbrook?
Yeah, because we had the temperament, too. You had in the temperament. But with Hopkins, and listen, I have watched, I actually had this argument with Ryan Lacy, who did our research the other day. And where did Lacy vote Hopkins, Gary?
Lacy had him 12.
I'm curious now.
I had him 14.
So I won the argument with Lacy. Lacy had him top five, and he and I got into an argument. And I have watched Hopkins with different I've watched him on film all his games myself, but then I've watched him on film with other defenders in the NFL. Cornerbacks, I've watched him. I've talked about him with defensive coordinators, offensive coaches, including multiple coaches who have had Hopkins, his coaches, over many years, and other analysts in the league. And every time, the consensus is crystal clear. He makes contested catches. He's great on that. He's hard to contend with. Mm-hmm. But let's watch the film, and when he's not getting targeted, look how inefficient his route running is. Look how methodical and slow and untwitchy he is. He takes forever to get in and out of his breaks. And you can't rely on him always. He's not where he's supposed to be too often. And that's one of the reasons Houston's offense has been as inconsistent as it is. Their best player is inconsistent. So Hopkins is a great talent as a contested catch guy, but that's the extent of what he is. And it's weird because he's so productive, it's hard to reconcile. But to me, DeAndre Hopkins is top 20, but absolutely no better than top 15.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about this a little bit with the Alshon Jeffrey Carson Wentz thing earlier this year, earlier in the show. you know, Deshaun Watson is coming in there in Houston, and we'll see when he's actually ready to get on the field. It figures to be Tom Savage, perhaps for the first part of the season. But, you know, when you have a new quarterback coming in, are you comfortable with a guy like DeAndre Hopkins as your number one receiver for a guy like Deshaun Watson, a new quarterback you're trying to break in?
I think that'll be tough for a quarterback to adjust to with Hopkins. You have to be willing to throw into coverage, basically. Hopkins will be covered. He's going to make more of those catches, but it goes against the natural instinct and what you learn as a quarterback. It goes against all of that when you're playing with him. You have to accommodate Hopkins.
All right. Well, I think that's going to be a wrap for our show. As we said, we'll have linebackers next week, and then we'll have the finale of this series, quarterbacks, in 2 weeks. That'll be the show that comes out on, July 24th at that point. And then we will have the big mailbag show. And like we said, leave a review on iTunes, leave your mailbag question there, and we guarantee we will answer it. But that'll do it for now. Thank you to our researcher this week. That was Ryan Lacy, helping us with all the stats, making us sound smart. Thank you to producer Lou Pellegrino, back from honeymoon. Congratulations again to Lou. And, of course, editor Chris Basil, always making us sound good. Those guys over at Digital Media, they're the best at what they do. Most of all, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We love getting your feedback. We always get smart questions from you. We are very appreciative of you. And like we said, keep those questions coming. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and of course, this show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.